I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Philip Seymour Hoffman, dead this week at the age of 46 from an apparent drug overdose. The governor of Vermont devoting his entire State of the State message this year to what he called a full-blown heroin crisis gripping that state. Last year, nearly twice as many people in Vermont died from heroin overdoses as the year before. Lawmakers in virtually every state are introducing legislation in response to what is rapidly being perceived as a public health crisis. The Centers for Disease Control says there's an epidemic of drug overdose deaths in America. The rate has tripled since 1990. In 2010, drug overdoses were responsible for 38,329 deaths. 30,006 were unintentional. This hour, we talk about addiction, and we'll have two guests with us, Dr. Andrew Kolodny, Chief Medical Officer for the Phoenix House Foundation and President of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, and Ann Gile will join us later, Director of Adult Residential Programs and Outpatients at Tellurian and Director of the Teresa McGovern Center. Both of those are based in Madison, Wisconsin. All hour, this is an issue that has touched so many people, the death of Philip Seymour. Hoffman cut through all of us like a knife, and there are so many families who have experienced early deaths. There are all of us know somebody who's had addiction problems, and they are so hard for families to deal with, in addition to the people who have the addictions. So I think we're going to get a lot of phone calls, and let me give you our phone number. Call as early as you would like, and you can also leave messages on Facebook and on our email. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is Chief Medical Officer for the Phoenix House Foundation in New York. In 72, they've been around longer than that, but they became a nonprofit and have grown. They are now the nation's leading provider of alcohol and drug abuse treatment and prevention services, operating more than 123 programs in 11 states. They do assessment, evaluation, detoxification, outpatient and residential programs, sober living residences, and after-school and day programs for teens. And we thank you so much, Dr. Kolodny, for being with us. Good afternoon to you.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I didn't realize, obviously, we're paying so much more attention to this issue this week because of the horrible death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, but we've got a problem on our hands, evidently. The governor of Vermont talking about this for his entire state, the state address, many people saying that we have a public health crisis on our hands. Do we?
We do, and one of the things that the governor said was that don't think that just because I'm devoting my entire state of the state to this topic, that Vermont has it worse than other states. He said that I'm just speaking out about it, but what's happening in Vermont is happening across the country. And he's absolutely right about that. The United States Centers for Disease Control is calling this the worst drug epidemic in United States history.
Oh, my goodness. Why? What's happening?
Well, this is, to be clear, this is an epidemic of people with the disease of opioid addiction. And when I use the word opioid, I'm referring to drugs derived from the opium poppy, which include heroin, but it also includes prescription painkillers like Vicodin, OxyContin, Percocet, Lortab. These are drugs which are all very similar. The molecule, for example, in hydrocodone is almost identical to the heroin molecule. In many ways, when we talk about prescription painkillers, we are talking about heroin pills. And what happened is that about 15 years ago, the medical community began to prescribe these medications aggressively for treating pain. And I think we did this with good intentions. There was a belief, we were actually being taught that we were underutilizing these medicines, that the compassionate way to treat a complaint of pain was with an aggressive opioid prescription. And so around 15 years ago, the prescribing for opioids began to take off. And that led to parallel increases in rates of addiction and overdose deaths. So every year for the past 15 years, overdose deaths have gone up. We've set a new record for drug overdoses, and rates of addiction have shot up.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, if you would, please, what happens to the body if you're taking one of those pills for medical reasons, for treating your pain? How do you become addicted to that? What happens physically to you that makes you crave that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I should say that these are very good medicines when used to ease suffering at the end of life. And when someone is at the end of life, you don't have to worry about getting them off of the medicines one day. And if you're using it at the end of life, they may not be on it that long. So if you have to keep increasing the dose, it's not so much of a problem. And these are very useful for palliative care. These are also very good medicines when used short-term for severe acute pain. That would be the pain you might experience after having major surgery, or the pain you might experience if you were involved in a serious accident. Where use of these medications is controversial is when you prescribe them to people long-term for common chronic conditions. And that was really the change that happened about 15 years ago. 15 years ago, the medical community understood that using these medicines to treat low back pain or chronic headache or fibromyalgia was not a good idea because these are addictive, and because you can develop tolerance to the analgesic effect, meaning that you need to take higher and higher doses once you've been on them for a while. Another thing that happens when you've been on them for a while is that your body becomes dependent on the medicine. And that begins to happen very quickly. If you take an opioid like Vicodin, for example, and if you take it a few times a day, every day, for a week or two, that's about all it takes for your body to become used to that medicine, which means that when you stop taking the medicine, you'll actually feel ill. You'll go through withdrawal symptoms.
In that short a period of time?
Yes, within a week or two. Of course, if you're on it for a longer period of time and if you're on higher doses, those withdrawal symptoms that you'll experience can be much more severe. But the withdrawal symptoms that I'm talking about are flu-like symptoms, but it's not just that people will feel physically ill. One of the other symptoms associated with opioid withdrawal is severe anxiety. It feels like a panic attack. It feels like you're going to die, a sense of impending doom, which is why people will go to great lengths to do everything they can to maintain their opioid supply.
So how was it that these became so widely prescribed? Did doctors not know the addictive potential of these drugs?
You know, we had a pretty good idea of their addictive potential up until around 96, 97, which was when, 1996 was actually the year that OxyContin was introduced by Purdue Pharma. And when they were, that's an extended release oxycodone. Oxycodone is the active ingredient in Percocet. And back in 1996, oxycodone pretty much only existed as Percocet, and Percocet would have been something used to treat severe acute pain. When they were introducing OxyContin, and they had an extended-release, long-lasting version of that drug, the company wanted to make sure that their product would be used for more than just people at the end of life with cancer pain. That's who extended-release opioids were being used for. And so they launched a marketing campaign and an educational campaign focused on getting the medical community to use these medications for common, chronic, moderately painful conditions. And you may hear me say this and you may think, well, come on, you guys went to medical school. How could you allow a drug company to fool you into prescribing an addictive drug? And it is hard to explain this, but these educational programs that they sponsored, which were often led by people who were eminent in the field of pain, and many of the people teaching these things truly believed that we were underutilizing these medicines. But the educational programs, they were very compelling. What they told doctors was that we were allowing people to suffer needlessly, that we can be much more compassionate, and that we were making the mistake of confusing physical dependence, meaning your body gets used to the medicine, with addiction. And they told us real addiction is extremely rare. And I guess if you want to believe something, and if you go into medicine because you want to help people, and you're being taught that you've got this wonderful gift from Mother Nature, and that older doctors have been letting people suffer, you kind of walk out of that classroom feeling like you're going to be different, and you know that you can prescribe more aggressively.
Right. So what is the connection between these opioids and heroin?
They're basically, heroin is an opioid.
I see.
And so they are basically, we're talking about the same drug. Heroin is more often available in a powder form as opposed to a pill. But the molecule is almost identical to an oxycodone molecule or a hydrocodone molecule. So if somebody is addicted to opioids, and there are two ways that you can get addicted to opioids. You can get addicted to opioids because you were using them for fun. So with pills, maybe you were using them, what we would use the term non-medically. You can think about a teenager who finds them in a medicine chest and takes them with their friends to have a good time and does it one too many times and starts to get used to them and then develops the disease of addiction that way. That's one group, and that group tends to be younger. And then the other group of people getting addicted to these medications they tend to be middle-aged and older, and these are people having these medicines prescribed to them for pain. And those are the two groups that are getting addicted to opioids right now. Once you've got this disease of opioid addiction, if you're in that first group, if you're a young adult without any real medical problems, you may have a hard time finding doctors who are going to write the pills for you. So pretty soon, you know, once you can't find them in medicine chests anymore, you're buying them from drug dealers. And if the pills can be very expensive on the black market, so what we see are young people who switch to heroin because it's less expensive. Another reason we see people switch to heroin is if they were crushing and snorting their pills, some of the pills are being made harder to crush and snort. So if you want to snort an opioid, that's another reason, or inject, it's another reason to switch to heroin.
Hmm. And is it, tell me, in the case of Philip Seymour Hoffman, we don't know if this is true or not, he claimed that he had been off drugs, and I assume he was talking about heroin, for something like 23 years. And then toward the end of his life, he appeared to be using frequently, maybe every 2 hours, to get a high from that. Why is it that somebody can be clean all of these years and then get drawn right back into something which he even admitted could kill him?
Not all addiction is chronic and lifelong. So, for example, there are people who may smoke marijuana very heavily and get into a real problem with it and flunk out of school, and it affects their life negatively. And then they sort of move on, and that sort of stays, becomes a problem of their past. Of course, some people could always have a problem with heavy marijuana smoking. But with some drugs that are highly addictive, the addiction to that drug can be lifelong, or even with a drug like alcohol.
Yes.
When for people who are addicted to alcohol, they are at risk for their entire life of relapsing to alcohol use. With opioids are probably our most addictive drugs. And if someone has experienced opioid addiction, that's now a chronic problem they're going to struggle with, and they will be at risk for relapse for the rest of their life. So what happened is not all that unusual.
Mm-hmm. What do we need to be doing to confront this epidemic?
That's a great question. So I've said, you know, when you say this epidemic, we should be clear what we're talking about, because sometimes people talk about this as an epidemic of people abusing drugs or abusing pain pills or abusing heroin. And that's not really the right way to frame this, because, you know, that's sort of, we're just framing it as people behaving badly with drugs. And certainly even people who are using them to get high are not all addicted. The correct way to frame this epidemic is as an epidemic of people who have the disease of opioid addiction. And when you think about it that way and you frame it that way, it becomes clear what we need to do to bring this crisis under control. And there are two things that we have to do, and they're the same. What we'd have to do for this disease epidemic, they're the same as what we would need to do for any disease epidemic. Number one, you need to prevent people from getting the disease in the first place. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to opioid addiction, since we know that even the heroin users, more than 80% will tell you that their opioid addiction began with exposure to pain pills, to prevent people from getting this disease in the first place, we need the medical community, we need doctors and dentists to prescribe more cautiously so that their patients don't get addicted, but so they also don't stock people's medicine chests with a hazard. That's the first thing we need to do, prevent people from getting this disease that's so difficult to treat. The second thing we need to do, though, is for the millions of Americans, truly millions, I'm not exaggerating, who now have this life-threatening chronic disease of opioid addiction, we have to see that they have access to effective treatment. If we only do the first thing I mentioned, if we only curtail the overprescribing without also ensuring that the people who are already addicted have access to treatment, we'll just continue to see more people turning to heroin. So we have to do both. The people who now have this disease of opioid addiction need access to effective treatment.
Well, we must be failing miserable on the second of those because of the number of deaths and the number of unintentional deaths from opioids and from heroin, which is an opioid. We're failing.
That's absolutely right. It's a lot, you know, doing the first part is a lot easier, and law enforcement approaches are a lot easier, but taking care of the millions of people who now have this disease, that's the harder part. And I think you can, if you think back to an epidemic we had about 20 years ago, the height of the AIDS epidemic, and actually it was in 1994 when we were at the height of the AIDS epidemic in the United States. And at that time, we had about 40,000, 45,000 Americans dying of HIV/AIDS. And it was by 96 that we had a wide-scale release of protease inhibitors and medications that were able to turn this life-threatening disease of HIV into a chronic disease. And we saw the number of people dying of HIV/AIDS just plummet. With drug overdose deaths, we're now at 40,000 drug overdose deaths in the United States. We're pretty close to where we were at the height of the AIDS epidemic with HIV/AIDS deaths, yet no sign whatsoever that we're going to be able to have that same precipitous drop in deaths. In fact, all of the trends indicate that overdose deaths are going to continue to rise.
We welcome phone calls. All of our phone lines are busy at the moment, but keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org, leave messages on our Facebook page as well, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our first guest this hour is Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He is Chief Medical Officer for the Phoenix House Foundation in New York City and President of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. We'll have another guest with us, the second part of our program, from Madison, the Director of Adult Residential Programs and Outpatients at the Tellurian and Director of the Teresa McGovern Center. To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to your many phone calls. Teresa in Madison, our first caller for you, Doctor. Hi, Teresa.
Hello. I have a family member who was a heroin addict, and it ended up with him actually being incarcerated. And I watched just his social group alone of about 10 boys. Every single one of them became a heroin addict. Mm. They did, by and large, sort themselves out. But I think that thinking about what your guest was saying, his second point about treatment, it's extremely difficult to get the population of the United States to agree to free treatment for drug addicts when there isn't free treatment for people who are diabetics or for people who have got other chronic or acute illnesses. It would be difficult for me to persuade someone on the South Side whose child needs glasses or whatever and who has to go through a lot of processes in order to get that, that my family member should immediately be allowed to go off for 6 months to, you know, the sunny Californian skies and have all the treatment he needs. And for many people, it can take up to 8 attempts before they're clean. This isn't just a quick in-out. This is an extremely long process. He talked about AIDS. Think about the AIDS fundraising that went on. The number of popular figures who came out and said, that's it, it's enough, we're bringing it out into the open. That massive movement, that's what led to AIDS being treated as something other than, you know, a funny disease that only gay men get and goodness knows how they caught it. It wasn't because the government turned around and said, oh dear, this is dreadful. So I think that, you know, one, to say you're surprised that this situation is going on, this has been going on for a long time. It's only coming out in the open. It's only being talked about now because this actor.
Dr. Khaladni.
I think those are all outstanding points. I agree with everything the caller just said.
So what do we do to be able to afford treatment, which, as she said, it can take several attempts for a treatment to be effective for a human being? How do we do this? How do we give the resources?
Well, I guess something that's unique about this opioid epidemic compared to the last opioid epidemic we had, which was a heroin epidemic in the 1970s, this epidemic is disproportionately affecting people who are white and middle class, whereas the epidemic in the 1970s disproportionately affected people who were in inner cities, who were low income, who were minority. And so the fact that it's affecting people who are middle class and at a time when there's an effort through the Affordable Care Act of expanding the number of Americans who have insurance, you know, I do think that most people with this disease do have health insurance or will soon have access to health insurance. So I do think that that care should be free. I would love to see that. I think one of the problems is that the existing models of care that are most readily available for opioid addiction treatment, for different reasons, are not helping us with this crisis. For example, methadone maintenance, which has some serious downsides to it, but did manage to help many people from that heroin epidemic of the 1970s stay alive. That was a good intervention when you had an epidemic that was concentrated in certain neighborhoods associated with the crime wave, and you could have people come to a methadone clinic every day to take their dose of methadone. But when you have an epidemic that's suburban and rural and spread everywhere, having people come into a clinic every day to pick up their dose doesn't work as well. One of the first-line treatments for this disease would be a medicine called buprenorphine or Suboxone, which, again, has I'm not going to say it's the panacea, but for most people with this disease, getting them stable on this medicine will help save their lives. And yet many of the existing drug treatment programs that saw themselves as alternatives to methadone and consider themselves abstinence-based programs have been sort of very much against the idea of using a medication like buprenorphine to assist somebody with their addiction treatment. So we need to do a much better job of expanding access to effective treatment programs. And it is quite true that many people, this is a chronic disease. So like other chronic diseases, people are prone to relapses and remissions. And we have to see that this is treated over a long period of time, that you can't just send someone for a rapid detox, send them home, and expect them to be cured. And in fact, if you detox people, which is perhaps one of the most common things people seek out when they're addicted, just detoxing people and sending them home, almost always people will relapse very quickly. And because you've lowered their tolerance when you detox them, they're actually at a higher risk of overdosing if they pick up and use the same amount they were using before they were detoxed.
It's such a terribly difficult disease, isn't it? On so many levels.
It is. But at the same time, there are many people who do quite well. I've been treating this disease for the past 10 years, and I've treated patients who developed this disease in their late teens, early 20s, and who have remained my patient. And I've watched them graduate college, get married, have babies. It's a chronic disease that needs to be managed, but people can do very well, both with medicine, but also 12-step, which is Alcoholics Anonymous. There's also Narcotics Anonymous. I've found that individuals for whom that model works, and it doesn't work for everyone, can often do very well when they take 12-step programs mm-hmm. seriously.
Well, we'd love to speak with some of those people. Maybe that's our next show on this, is to talk with people who have found successful treatment. Let's go next to Eric in Wisconsin. Hi, Eric.
Hello. I got so much to say, but I guess I'll keep it brief. I was using since I was 14, 43, clean for 5 years, relapsed for the last 2 years. And it seems like the hardest part I've had in my life is law enforcement intervention in my life. That's the hardship the drugs have brought onto me. And instead of, I can't count how many times I got thrown in jail, and they treated you worse there than they're legally allowed to treat terrorists. I'm not angry about that. I think they think they're doing what they can do. But I couldn't agree more with your guest, seeing it from the inside, that at least 90% of the heroin addicts I've known have started with pills and doctors who freely prescribe these pills. And we're off suing, government goes off and sues tobacco companies for, you know, billions of dollars to help people pay for their medical bills. But these companies that push this other stuff are allowed to just run amok.
Dr. Kolodny.
I agree completely with your caller. And I will say that there now are some governments, some state and county governments, that are looking at lawsuits against opioid manufacturers. So, for example, the city of Chicago is going to be suing a few different companies that manufacture these pills because of claims these companies made that they were safer and more effective than they were, and because of their campaigns to encourage aggressive prescribing. And I think this comparison to tobacco is quite right. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, in the same way that the tobacco companies tried to claim that tobacco was not addictive, you've had the opioid manufacturers paying doctors to teach other doctors that opioids are not really addictive.
Thank you, Eric, and all the best to you. Let's take one more call for this doctor, and then we will change our guests. And let's go to Joe in Lac des Flambeaux. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Kathleen. Your guest has implied, at least somewhat, that the answer, the main answer to opiate addiction is through formal intervention and treatment, i.e., you know, programs in hospitals, et cetera, clinics. But I'd like him to address the importance of informal social controls. Lee Robbins, who was a researcher at Washington University in the 70s, followed Vietnam veterans who were addicted coming back. And her study was pretty remarkable, the findings, in that she followed a sample of something like 400. And after a year of coming back, I think it was something like 80%, somewhere along there, 90% had kicked the opioid habit without formal treatment whatsoever.
And how was it done?
By informal. Well, the opinion by many people at that time, and I think continued, is it was through informal social controls. That is, people who mean something
right
to the person hold them accountable for their behavior.
Dr. Kolodny.
Sure. I'm familiar with that study by Lee Robbins. And what they did was they looked at people who, while in Vietnam, Americans fighting in Vietnam, were using opioids, and what happened to them when they returned to the United States. And they found that many of them stopped using. I'm not sure I agree with the caller's explanation for why they stopped using, and I'm not sure it's a good comparison to what's happening today. The people fighting in Vietnam were smoking opium. They might have been snorting heroin, but they were using, many of them were not using all that regularly. They were using when they could, and some of them may have in fact been addicted. But even the people who were, even the Americans fighting who did become addicted to opioids while in Vietnam, were using doses much lower than what we see today, much lower than what we would see even with pain patients who are wind up on hundreds of milligrams of morphine on a daily basis, and they're on it every day for months and years. And the changes that occur in the brain from that type of high-dose, prolonged exposure are different from someone who might have been sniffing heroin or smoking opium sporadically while fighting. Now, when you have veterans who come back, if they come back into the United States, if you were fighting in Vietnam and you returned to the South Bronx, your chance, and you were addicted to opioids in Vietnam, I think your chance of being remaining off of drugs in the South Bronx were much lower than if you returned home to Madison, Wisconsin, where you couldn't find heroin. So I think the fact that 80% of these people came back into neighborhoods where heroin was not easily available is a better explanation for why they did so well when they returned.
Thank you very much for your call, Joe. Dr. Kolodny, thank you so much for being with us. Well, I don't know if any of your patients, even some you are still seeing now, would be willing to talk, but we would like to do a show on that at some point. So,
sure, happy to discuss that with you.
Good. We'll be back in touch with you, and thank you ever so much for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny, he is the Chief Medical Officer for the Phoenix House Foundation, President of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. Those of you who are online, please stay where you are. We're continuing our conversation, just a different guest. Ann Guile will join us momentarily, Director of Adult Residential Programs and Outpatients at Tellurian in Madison and Director of the Teresa McGovern Center. So we will talk more about services that they provide for problems related to substance abuse and addictions, mental illness, and homelessness. Our number, a couple lines are open if you've been trying to get through, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. You can always leave your messages on our Facebook page as well, because we like to read those, and for a topic like this, it might be important to read what people have to say. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter at KDunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And Ann Guile is joining us now, Director of Adult Residential Programs and Outpatients at Tellurian and Director of the Teresa McGovern Center in Madison. And they do programs, of course, that relate to substance abuse and addictions, mental illness, and homelessness. The Teresa McGovern Center was started with support. You're probably aware of this story. Senator George McGovern, his daughter died from addiction and mental health challenges. And we thank you very much, Ann, for joining us. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
We spent a good portion of the first 40 minutes of the show talking about the fact that there seemed to be a problem with a number of centers that we have in this country that will deal with problems of addiction and mental health. And I'm wondering if that's the case in Wisconsin. Is access to treatment, if you really want to get it, available?
Treatment is available. Access to treatment is available more than it has been for a long time with folks with insurance coverage. We have seen a little decrease in county-based funding because of our current economic climate, but it is available, it is accessible, and we're doing it here mm-hmm. at our facility.
And what is it? Would you say that there are common threads among the many facilities in this country that deal with this, or is there something unique about what you're doing that you feel is successful?
Well, I think one of the things that's really successful about what we do is we treat each patient as an individual. This isn't a one-size-fits-all treatment. We look at what is going on with this particular patient. Are they struggling with mental health disorder as well as the addictive disorder? What is their support system? What, you know, have they tried in the past that's worked and hasn't worked? We really, everyone is an individual, and their treatment plans are individualized. And I think that's a very significant thing that we offer.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it is that we can do to keep people from even trying these substances? I mean, do we have alternatives for opiate kinds of drugs that are used for pain? Do we have prevention programs and don't even start using some of these drugs in place in our schools? How do we take that on?
I think prevention is definitely a piece of it, and I always think prevention could be increased and improved, of course. There's still always going to be people who try these drugs, and so, you know, prevention combined with how do we catch it early? You know, this is a progressive disease, so if one continues to use, it does get worse over time, and meaning the consequence and the disease consequences that come with the disease become worse. The disease itself becomes worse. So I think it's both, yes, prevention, talking to kids, helping kids understand. I think a big thing is helping them understand that, yes, in the beginning, you may have, you know, these euphoric effects, but in the end, most people who come into our treatment programs, specifically here in residential, will tell you it's less about the euphoria and more about feeling normal. They feel more normal when that substance is in their system. And as your previous guest, Dr. Kladny, described, escaping or trying to avoid that significant withdrawal.
And realistically, how many attempts does it take to rid yourself of addiction? How many times going through rehab?
You know, for some people, it's the first time.
Is it?
Yeah. Do some people need more than one time? Yes. But the big thing that I tell patients is that if you have been in treatment before, it's not all for nothing. You took something from that treatment. If you have to come in a second time, you build upon what worked, look at what didn't work, what do we need to add to your treatment to make you successful. And so do I know people who the first treatment, they've had years of recovery? Absolutely. But will I say that's for every single person? No, of course not. Just like we wouldn't say that for, you know, other chronic diseases.
Let's go to phone calls. We have a lot of people who want to participate this hour. Lynn in La Crosse. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just curious. My sister was prescribed Valium in approximately 2007. Her husband, my brother-in-law, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in 2005. He died in 2009. She has continued on this Valium. And when I talk to her, I'm not, she lives several states away. But when I talk to her, she sometimes jokes about, well, she'll just take a Valium when she wants to calm down. I'm concerned that she's probably addicted, and I do think she probably uses the Valium every day rather than just when she wants to calm down. But I don't know. I've not had conversations with her about that. I just listen when she talks. And I'm wondering, one, why would a doctor continue to prescribe that medication? And two, is it possible she is addicted and doesn't realize it? And she has never had an addictive personality. I mean, not a drinker, not a smoker. In my mind, not an addictive personality.
All right, Anne.
Why would a doctor prescribe this medication? I, you know, would believe it sounds like it originally started with anxiety, natural reaction to, you know, personal, significant personal issues that she had to deal with. And over time, you know, why has it been prescribed for so long, I think is what I hear you asking. Again, I can't say for sure, you know, and one question that would come to me is, has she switched doctors? You know, that can often be a marker, if you will, to a problem beginning, is they'll do what we call doctor shopping, switch doctors once one tries to cut them off of a medication. And, you know, looking, what I would suggest is trying to just have a conversation with her, just a non-judgmental, you know, conversation about, you know, how she's doing in general, maybe. And that might spark a conversation. If someone is developing a problem, one of the premier symptoms, you know, of addiction is denial. And so, you know, it can be very hard, or someone, you know, may have ways that they justify why they still need it. So that can be difficult. But that would be my suggestion, is just trying to have a discussion.
Thank you, Lynn, so much for your call. Jim in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. Say, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Everything the doctors say is so on track. I haven't went a day without using opiates for 4 years.
Mm.
I'm very fortunate that I don't know where heroin is, or I'm sure that would lead to that. The questions I have, I want off, and I want off badly. I have a family, I have a job, everything going in life except for this trap that I'm in, addiction to this pill that haunts me. Every day I seek it out. I'm able to find it because I have my resources that I've built up through the years. But I'm scared of the withdrawals. Even today, I went 4 hours without a pill. The yawns, the stomach cramps, it just comes with the feeling of, I don't know what to do to get out of this hurt and pain of not having a pill.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is so on track, what you're saying, because of the seeking for it. You know, I have the financial ability for it, but I just don't have the resource. Yes, I have insurance, but then, you know, I don't want my employment to find out. You know, there's a lot of things I got to keep hidden from it.
Right. Yeah, you do have to keep a lot of it hidden. And
well, what you're describing is what many people struggle with, and why they hesitate towards treatment. There are things that we can do, for instance, in our detox facility, to make the withdrawal at least a little more comfortable. You know, prescription. Non-addictive or less addictive prescriptions to help you through the withdrawal, such as clonidine. And, you know, there is going to be some discomfort, but you can avoid some of the extreme discomfort, which it sounds like you've already had. And then, you know, one of the options, you know, after you're sober for 48 to 72 hours can be Suboxone replacement therapy, which we offer at our facility and outpatient clinic as well. So, you know, my best advice would be to call to get an assessment, let, you know, there be help with the detox and consider replacement therapy, because it's not for everyone, but as the doctor prior to me discussed, you know, for some people, Suboxone does make sense.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried a rehab, Jim?
18 years ago, I was in treatment and more or less a little meth, a little coke, drinking right in college. I thought I was just par for the course, you know, partying with them, staying up to study. And after treatment, I haven't touched meth since. I still drink on a regular basis. No longer use marijuana, things like that. But this pill has got me so tight. It's the withdrawal.
Right.
I think if I didn't have to go through the withdrawal, I could get away from it. And like I said, now treatments like that you know, you go to treatment for a month, and yeah, it would work, and at least in my head it would. But to take me away from the family and the job and the things that I would, you know, I'm scared of it. I'm scared of the pain that I'm going to go through to withdraw. It's so much easier to stay on the drug and pay for it financially than it is to get off it and go through the cramps and the anxiety, as the other doctor said, because it's...
Well, I'm hearing a little bit of pain in your voice right now, Jim.
It's there daily, especially when my wife and I talk about it. She's, you know, she's the only support, the best support I got, because she's aware of it. She knows what the symptoms are of going through the withdrawal, so she's there to support me to stay in the habit, but she wants me off it. But she doesn't, you know, she knows what I go through if I don't have the drug.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier just to support, let's get you the pills so you're not hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to give a website at least so Jim can go right to the website after we hang up here, Ann?
Yes. He can go to www.tellurian, TellurianTellurian.org. And you can find the information on there and how to reach us. Yes, I think everything you're describing, Jim, is so, so common. And what I would say is, you know, I understand it feels like taking these pills and getting the pills, it makes it easier. But long term, I will tell you that you're just avoiding the inevitable because things will get worse.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jim. Let's go to Sam in Minocqua. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Sam.
You there?
We're here, Sam.
Yeah, see, you mind if I flip the coin and put it to the other side, people that actually need these pills? I don't know if you know what it's like to actually be in pain, but I used to be a combat engineer and also a logger and push my body to limits that probably a lot of you don't. And got a lot of things going on, but the worst thing that I got is called spinal stenosis and bulging disc. And for 5 years, I suffered with this and was treated like a little narcoleptic, you know, somebody trying to beg for pills and all that. So then, you know, you don't want to be treated like that. So then you turn to the whiskey or you turn to the marijuana and all that. And that certainly ain't the answer, because you got these people out there just popping pills for the fun of it. So at that time, I was going down to the Milwaukee VA, and then I moved, and I was able to go up to the Iron Mountain VA, and they actually treated me like a human and diagnosed my actual symptoms. And I can tell you, you know, I'm getting my injections now and that, and I don't abuse them. I take them when I actually need them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they call that pain clinic or whatever. And I can tell you one thing. It's a lot nicer being treated like an actual human when they do the MRIs and the ultrasounds and they say, yeah, this guy really needs something, versus somebody just doing a lot of guessing and saying, ah, you know, he probably don't need it. Why even bother? And, you know, I appreciate the show, and I always call in about every couple years, but thanks a lot for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks, Sam, very much. And, of course, you should always be treated as a human. I guess it's begging the question here whether or not several people have wondered if there are drugs, if all of these drugs for pain management are addictive drugs eventually, or are there alternatives to opiates?
There's certainly medications available that have a less likelihood of addiction. And, you know, there are some medications that, you know, may be developed for one thing, and then they figure out over time of people's reporting and experience that, oh, this also seems to lessen pain they were experiencing. So, you know, there are less addictive medications, and that's obviously what folks who do have an addiction, because pain is real, we know that. We can never guarantee that no one's ever going to, you know, go the rest of their life without pain. And as he said, you know, human beings, and they deserve respect. We're not ever saying no one, you know, that they don't deserve to have their pain treated. It's just, you know, treating it with less addictive medication.
Right. Ann, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ann Guile, Director of Adult Residential Programs and Outpatients at Tellurian and Director of the Teresa McGovern Center, which was established by Senator George McGovern, who lost a daughter to this disease. There are a lot of messages in our Facebook page. We just didn't have time. We had so much response to this particular hour. It obviously is of huge concern and a significant issue in society right now. So thank you to KP Whaley for doing on-air production, and thanks to Marika Suval for producing this program. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll do a follow-up, and we'll talk. I think that we need to hear from people who have been through rehab, who have suffered this, and who have come out on the other side for a long period of time, maybe after several tries, but they're okay. So we'll do that in a little while. This is the Ideas Network.